All right, welcome listeners to episode 51 of Know Your Enemy. I'm Matt Sittman, your podcast co-host. I'm here with my friend Sam Edler-Bell. How's it going, Sam?
It's going good. It's going well.
That's right.
I never ask you how you're doing.
I know, it's the push and pull, the flow of the intro. It doesn't really work, but I'm doing great. I'm doing really well. Listeners may know I quit my day job as an editor at Common Wheel. So I'm writing full-time and podcasting full-time. So I'm really excited about that. And I think that means you'll get more of my stuff to read. And I think more of the podcast, too.
For better or for worse. Just kidding.
That's right. Now I now have one coworker, and his name's Sam Edler-Bell. And Jesse Brenneman. So two coworkers total.
One you get along with and one you can't fucking stand.
So what's the new episode about, Sam?
We have a really good episode. It's an episode that listeners have requested for a long time for good reason. We're talking today about the aggressive attack on trans rights that the right has been prosecuting for, well, many, many years, but that has ramped up in the past year or so.
That's right. And we had the perfect guest for it, our friend Jillian Brandstetter, who is the press secretary for the National Women's Law Center, a gender justice organization based in Washington, D.C. She works a lot doing media strategy, workshops, public advocacy, working with reporters, editors, and advocates to promote accurate and thorough coverage about transgender people and their rights. She also has written a lot, been featured in the media, the New York Times, Washington Post, Time, Newsweek, BBC. So she's really someone who knows the ins and outs of both these proposed laws, these anti-trans bills, and, you know, more positively, what it means to support trans people and their, you know, the healthcare they need, the rights and dignity they deserve, and the ins and outs of that too.
Yeah. I was so happy we got to have her on. We've been mutuals on Twitter for a long time. I've been a long, long time admirer of hers. And so it was great to have her on Know Your Enemy.
Yes. It was a tough topic to talk about, but Jillian was great, and we hope you like it. Before we get to the episode, a few housekeeping items. We'd like to thank, as always, our sponsors at Dissent. They provide digital subscriptions if you subscribe to Know Your Enemy for $10 or more on Patreon.com. You can do that, patreon.com/KnowYourEnemy. But also, for $5 a month, you have access to all of our bonus episodes. So please do consider subscribing.
And as always, we want to thank our intrepid producer, Jesse Brenneman, who's back and making this episode sound as good as it does, and Will Epstein, who provides the music for the podcast. And the periodic plug to rate and review us on iTunes.
That's right.
Because it helps.
Help us in the algorithm wars.
Yeah, some kind of sorcery, which is to our benefit.
Yes. Well, with that, let's get to it. Here's our episode with Jillian Brandstetter.
Enjoy.
All right, let's get started. Welcome to Know Your Enemy, Jillian Brandstetter.
It's such a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, we're really excited. I mean, it's a dark subject we're talking about, so excited's kind of not the right word, but you're just the perfect guest to have on to talk about a tough subject today.
I say excited mostly because I know you guys provide a lot of space for nuance and in-depth discussion on these issues. And trans rights is something that in a lot of mainstream political commentary just gets treated as almost a distraction or as culture war fodder or as a wedge issue. And I think it's actually more central both in the rights thinking in their movement and in how we can successfully push back against it.
Jillian, so like just to get started, so our listeners get even a better sense of you than they got from the introduction, who are you and what kind of work do you do with the National Women's Law Center?
Sure. So I'm the press secretary for the National Women's Law Center. The National Women's Law Center, just so you know, is about to celebrate its 50th anniversary. And it is a gender justice organization coming from a feminist perspective across a broad range of issues, including the fight for equal pay, the fight for safety in schools, the fight against sexual harassment, as well as advancing the need for universal child care, for a robust social safety net. And for my part, I work on a number of cross-cutting issues, including our nomination for judges. I manage our child care and income security portfolio. and our LGBT rights portfolio, which is growing and expanding. So on trans rights and LGBT rights that we're going to talk about today, we're active on amicus briefs in federal court as people are seeking to challenge discriminatory laws or advance for proactive good laws that actually work to support trans youth, as well as do things like submit written testimony against a lot of these bad bills we see and provide communication support, development support to a lot of LGBT rights organizations.
Awesome. So you've got a lot of free time and you're not very busy.
Most of my part is working with journalists. So before I was at the National Women's Law Center, I was at the National Center for Transgender Equality. And that's where I really started to build what I think is a reputation amongst reporters for being able to answer a lot of their questions about trans people. And they have a lot of them. And I'm always happy. I'm always happy to walk people through both sort of the 101 stuff and the like pronouns, names, some of the basic vocabulary of trans existence, as well as some of the 201 stuff and hopefully some of the more in-depth stuff like what we're going to talk about today.
I was going to say, we'll put all this in the show notes, but you're great to follow on Twitter. Just for the information, for many other reasons too, but you've been someone I've learned a lot from, and I'm looking forward to learning more during this conversation. You know, we wanted to start by not being abstract, not digging into philosophy or the rhetoric, even the political, you know, messaging around trans issues, but what's actually happening right now on the ground. And I was struck by, in preparation for this, Jillian, you sent us an amazing reading list. And one of them was a New York Times story from 2019 talking about, the Kentucky governor campaign in which trans issues figured prominently. But it gave this kind of background that to read it now was striking. And it talked about how since 2013, I'm reading from the piece now, Republican legislators in dozens of states, from Alaska to Texas to Tennessee, have introduced bills that would enact a wide assortment of limitations on transgender rights. And it lists some examples. And then the next paragraph, it says, nearly all have failed or stalled. And if anything, the tide has even turned among Republicans. And it mentioned, like, the former governor of South Dakota vetoed a 2016 bill that would have created a law stopping transgender people from using the bathroom that corresponds to their gender identity. And so in this article, you know, trans issues were pitched as like a losing one for Republicans, that they'd kind of come out on the wrong end of, say, the bathroom bill controversies. And even Republican governors had vetoed some of this legislation. And now we see a wave of anti-trans and more broadly anti-LGBTQ bills. So, you know, how did we get to this point, at least in the short term? You know, we can go back to Anita Bryant, at least, and her Save the Children campaign. But maybe without going back that far, kind of what's happening now? Like, kind of where are we at? And kind of what's the immediate prehistory of some of this, especially given it, even in the New York Times, they were portraying this as a losing cause for the right in the Republican Party.
So first off, you know, the fight for trans rights is very old, and trans advocacy in the United States going back nearly a century alone. And trans people, of course, have been around as long as there's been gender. There have been people who've subverted and transgressed gender roles.
Right.
But thinking in the more near term, for now, let's start in 2016. And some people remember that in 2016, there was a big fight in North Carolina over what has generally been called a bathroom bill. This is a law that would force transgender people to use a bathroom that doesn't align with their gender identity. So usually going back to what was on their original birth certificate. So for example, I'm a transgender woman and my original birth certificate would be listed as male. So they would force me to use the men's restroom, for example, as well as men's locker rooms, changing mm-hmm. rooms, things like this, right? This was passed and signed into law by Pat McCrory in 2016, who was the governor of North Carolina. And there was a massive wave of public attention, but also a massive backlash by the business community of North Carolina. So you saw big players like the NBA pulling their all-star game out of the state. You saw, Bruce Springsteen saying that he wasn't going to tour. Perhaps in 2022's parlance, you would say that we canceled North Carolina.
No, that's woke capital.
Right. Yes, exactly. And you know what? Not a bad starting point for that conversation either. But as well as you know, a very conscious litigation push, this was really the first time that you saw any Department of Justice or any presidential administration step up for trans rights when Loretta Lynch's attorney general filed a lawsuit against HB2. And broadly speaking, Pat McCrory lost his job in no small part because of that. He remains the only politician to have lost his job because he talked too much about trans people. And I think that made a lot of conservative politicians very hesitant to touch it as an issue, not because they weren't aligned on it philosophically or because there wasn't movement from the evangelical movement or the Catholic legal movement, but because it seemed to them that the talking points weren't clear, right? They didn't know how to message it. They didn't know how the public would respond. And the fact that North Carolina walked away with, I mean, they lost by one study, $3 billion to their economy just through the HB2 fight alone.
Wow.
And I think that made a lot of governors and state legislators really hesitate to pick this up. Then something else happened in 2016, you might remember, which was that Donald Trump won election. And almost as soon as they got their foot in the door, they began repealing a lot of good work that trans advocates had fought for under the Obama administration. So, for example, the first day of Betsy DeVos' tenure as Secretary of Education in the Trump administration, she repealed guidance to schools on respecting the rights of transgender students and building safer learning environments for transgender students. By July, they had banned transgender people from enrolling in the military. They informed federal contractors that they were allowed to openly discriminate against transgender people. They told the Bureau of Prisons to begin forcing transgender women into men's prisons, where they have 10 times the rate of sexual assault. They let transgender people and many others die in ICE detention. I mean, they went so far as, I remember the Department of Agriculture under Trump stepping into a argument that was occurring in the statewide 4-H association in the state of Iowa, because the director of that 4-H chapter had said that LGBT young people were welcome into the 4-H program. And the agriculture department threatened their funding because they were willing to openly embrace a non-discrimination policy within their organization.
Just to underscore this, any talk that like Trump didn't really care about social issues, or he represents a different kind of Republican that was kind of okay with gay people or LGBT people more broadly, that's all total bullshit.
Oh yeah, and I'm not done. They left no stone unturned, right? I think the Trump administration was really when we started to see the Republican Party introduce what was basically a zero tolerance policy for transgender people. And there was a memo that was authored by Roger Severino, who was the director of the Office of Civil Rights within the Department of Health and Human Services, that basically laid out a blueprint for erasing transgender people from the federal government. And not just transgender people, but really the concept of gender. I remember, you know, Mike Pompeo's State Department going as far as telling the UN to remove the word gender from UN statements regarding what we would call gender-based violence, but they were really pressing to call violence against women. And I only go into that level of detail about their actions because, to your point, I think a lot of people really presumed that, you know, there was a moment in the 2016 campaign where Donald Trump took a photo holding a rainbow flag, right? And it said, like, it was hand-drawn to, like, LGBTs for Trump. I can see it in my head right now. And
the same marker that he changed the course of the hurricane with,
yes,
he used to put in the same black Sharpie.
I, you know, throughout the course of his administration, anytime that trans rights would come to, you know, mainstream political reporters' attention, which frankly was not enough, they would raise this point. And it's like, well, don't you feel betrayed? And it's like, well, first off, I didn't believe him. And second, it's important to remember the context that he was saying a lot of this thing. And I just had cause to remember this again because Marco Rubio took a stance in favor of this Don't Say Gay bill in Florida recently. Both Trump and Rubio had a brief flirtation with embracing, you know, at least vocal support for LGBT people, including transgender people, after the Pulse nightclub shooting, because they saw it as basically a means of using queer people as a cudgel against Muslim refugees. Not that those are mutually exclusive groups, but just another great example of how, you know, the goldfish memory of our political process sometimes, how quickly that's forgotten. But also just the degree to which, you know, performative steps towards allyship tend to be very convincing to everyone but queer people, which we can get into as far as like how that plays into woke capital and stuff like that.
As you kind of say a little more about what's happening now, I think one aspect to fold into it might be what they did learn from, say, losing the fight over the bathroom bills in North Carolina? What have they learned? How has their rhetoric shifted, or the focus of anti-trans legislation has focused from bathrooms to schools or gender-affirming care? What's the right doing now, but what have they learned too?
One thing is you've seen a solidifying around the messaging of transgender people broadly. First off, they would not refer to us as transgender people. Broadly speaking, they won't refer to somebody like me as a transgender woman. They would refer to me as a biological male, right?
Or the term transgenderism.
Yes, or gender ideology. Yes, which is maybe like the gender equivalent of like critical race theory as far as how it's getting used as a bogeyman. But while Trump's administration was doing a lot of that work, I think at the behest of sort of, you know, Federalist Society types, ADF types, I mentioned Roger Severino, who was, of course, involved in the Federalist Society, and his wife is Carrie Severino at the Judicial Crisis Network.
ADF is Alliance Defending Freedom.
Yes.
I'm sure we'll talk about them more as we go along.
They'll come up. And Roger Severino, curiously, the only thing I remember knowing about him is that in his office, he only had two personal effects, one of which was a Bible and another of which was a bobblehead of Clarence Thomas. But I think he's instructive as sort of one of these quiet power players, right? It's kind of odd to call him quiet. He's talked to the March for Life and stuff like this, but he's not a Steven Crowder. He's not, you know, he's not one of these sort of large audience propagandists that we see. And I think he's instructive for sort of who is sharpening the tools to be used against transgender people that we're seeing now. So before we get to legislative session, one more pivot point, which was June of 2020, which was a busy month, you may remember, but there was a critical victory at the Supreme Court for LGBT rights in Bostock v. Clayton County. So these were a collection of cases in which LGBT people, including a transgender woman named Amy Stevens, were fired from their jobs. And it was not up for debate whether they were fired for discriminatory reasons. What the Supreme Court was hearing was whether the discrimination they faced was prohibited by Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which prohibits sex discrimination in employment. And the Alliance Defending Freedom, which is this very large conservative legal powerhouse, which you know, had a lot of its alumni stocked throughout the Trump administration, and a lot of its alumni put onto lifetime appointments on the federal bench, argued this case and lost 6-3 with an opinion coming from Neil Gorsuch, no liberal ninny, writing in favor of the LGBT workers in this case and ruling in effect that laws that prohibit sex discrimination prohibit discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. The Alliance Defending Freedom lost, and definitely, I think, was not expecting it. You saw people like Harry Severino calling this deeply unfounded and a massive failure. You saw Senator Josh Hawley calling it the end of the conservative legal movement, which I think says a lot about how they view the conservative legal movement.
If Gorsuch could use textualism to come to the conclusion that this protection was built into the Constitution, then it's all over. What's the point of having this hermeneutic for interpreting the Constitution?
And I believe, too, then it was later that summer, August of 2020, when Adrian Vermeule published his Common Good Conservatism essay in The Atlantic arguing against originalism, right? Yeah. If the rule brought us to this point, why keep following it?
It's almost as if it was just a pretext to come to preordained policy goals. Who's to say? So walking away from this case, the Alliance Defending Freedom and really the conservative legal movement as a whole has been deeply embarrassed. I mean, remember, they stole a Supreme, you know, the conservative legal movement stole a Supreme Court seat from the nation's first black president in order to weigh the dice that they just lost on. Yeah. To say nothing of, I mean, this was after the Kavanaugh fight, right? So in 2020, so before that Supreme Court ruling, we saw 79 anti-LGBT bills introduced across the country with very few passing, I think just one or two, right? Because of that fear that people had from the North Carolina fight that was still instilled in a lot of people. Then in 2021, after they suffer that Supreme Court loss, you have over 150, so it nearly doubles. And a number gets signed into law, including an athlete ban in Idaho and a ban on updating birth certificates. And then we come to this year where we have surpassed 250 anti-LGBT bills introduced in state legislators across the country. the vast majorities are explicitly targeting transgender students or transgender rights. 29 are bans on gender-affirming care, a term you're going to hear me use a lot. Gender-affirming care is an oft misunderstood area of medicine, particularly as it applies to kids. But frankly speaking, without getting too much into it, it's helpful to see it separated by age groups. So for example, when you know an elementary school age kid begins wanting to identify as a girl, go to school as a girl, grow their hair out, or identify as a boy or non-binary, right? They generally aren't receiving any kind of health care. They usually might experience what's called a social transition. And it's just those kinds of affects. It's maybe going by a different name at school, maybe trying out new pronouns. But generally speaking, the model that a lot of healthcare workers work with and pediatricians broadly have endorsed, the affirming model, speaks to sort of just giving them room to explore, especially when they're that young. Simply so they have the time to sort of find themselves and be sure if they want to move on to the next step. So if we're thinking in middle school, if a child's identifying as trans, they might access what are known puberty blockers. These are entirely reversible means of basically pausing the secondary sexual characteristics that children adopt during puberty. So it's really just a means of giving families even more time, right, to monitor a child's overall well-being, to give them a chance to experience life basically in this new gender, right? And then for transgender adolescents, you might see what's called hormone replacement therapy. So for example, if they're seeking feminizing effects, they would take estrogen as well as medication to block the body's production of testosterone. Or if they're seeking masculinizing effects, if they're a transgender boy, they might seek out testosterone. And on some extremely rare occasions, older teens, 16, 17-year-olds, might access gender-affirming surgery. But for the most part, that doesn't really happen. And if it does, it's usually among kids who have been consistently and persistently presenting in their identity for more than a decade. These are endorsed by the broad mainstream of the medical community, by the American Medical Association, the American Psychological Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics. They're the result of, no kidding, a century of research. Gender-affirming care is older than antidepressants.
Are you suggesting to me that those institutions know better what kids need for their health and well-being than Josh Hawley?
Dare I? I think... And I lay all that out for the explicit reason that I think that when most people hear the words transgender and healthcare, they immediately leap to surgery.
Right.
And it's important to understand that when we are talking about kids, especially young kids, they're never really accessing anything that's permanent. And the sort of older teenagers who on very rare occasions are generally people who came out at, three or four. And have been persistently and consistently presenting. And this healthcare is strongly evidence-based. It's also strongly individualized. It's not a factory. it's not sort of a conveyor belt. And it's important to understand that everybody takes these decisions very seriously. Parents do, healthcare providers do. They're making these decisions in consultation with psychologists, with psychiatrists, right, usually bringing the school along. So we've seen 29 bills just this session attempt to ban that care. That care, which, by the way, transgender kids are four times as likely to have experienced a suicide attempt as their right, non-transgender peers. And access to this care decreases it by as much as 70%. Wow. In some studies, in fact, brings it down to lower rates than their cisgender peers. So Understand that this is the only method we have to treat what is really a mental health crisis amongst transgender teens. And these states are seeking to ban it. One of these already passed in Arkansas. Luckily, it is currently blocked from enforcement by a federal judge's order. And then another has been enacted in Texas, but not really through legislation, and we'll get into Texas shortly. A lot of these other bills, easily the most common one, is focused on trans athletes. I think this in particular has been pitched as a easy get for politicians, one that relies on a lot of assumptions about sex and gender that people have. You know, I say it tends to be really ripe for propaganda because most people don't know a transgender person, but unfortunately, most people also don't watch women's sports. So You're lying about a black box within a black box. You're talking about people they haven't met playing sports they largely don't watch. So, of course, they're more likely to believe that trans women are out there dominating athletic competitions day and night when we know they're not.
It's one of those moments, and we'll probably talk about this kind of thing more later, but it's one of those moments where on a rhetorical and sort of affective level, they're able to situate it as a fairness issue for girls. And one of the things that I found in that 2019 article where they were sort of testing out these new kinds of rhetoric about sports and trans athletes in sports as sort of the new hotness for conservative interventions in trans rights was that the president of American Principles Project, as all these laws to help trans kids have passed, he was quoted as saying, quote, the world hasn't fallen apart. And so they needed to find something that made people feel like the world was falling apart. And he says, this is from the New York Times article, it says, Mr. Cannon said that emphasizing children in sports made the case stronger because it focused on, quote, the idea that you are taking something away from people. Yeah. And that's where they don't like it.
Yeah.
Sam, I think it's in that same New York Times article, they describe a television ad. It might have been actually run by American Principles Project, but related to that Kentucky governor's race, where it had like two female wrestlers, and the referee was about to like name the winner, and it said a boy like jumps under the screen, and the referee lifts up the boy's hand as the winner, and that gets to Sam's point that it's, you know, with say the bathroom issue, you know, the fairness issue cut the other way. Well, shouldn't people just be able to use the bathrooms they want? Isn't that kind of just the decent thing to do? And I'm interested in the shift to sports precisely for the reason Sam indicated. It's they found a way to make the quote-unquote fairness cut the other way.
That is a major theme in anti-trans propaganda, that trans rights may come at the expense of somebody else. I don't think it's a new feature in conservative propaganda to suggest that a minority group's fight for equal rights might come at your expense.
Matt, is that a Jeopardy thesis?
It's from our second ever episode on The Rhetoric of Reaction, Albert Hirschman's book. Yeah, Futility, Jeopardy, and
Perversity.
And yeah, Jeopardy is an existing right is imperiled by the rise of some new demand.
We'll get to perversity later.
I hope we do.
So sports is very ripe for this framework of pitting people against one another because in sports, there are always winners and losers.
Right.
Yeah.
And the bottom line is that if you believe that transgender women are women, then there is no way in which a transgender woman could illegitimately win a women's sports competition.
Right.
And people walk into athletic competitions with all nature of advantages, right? How many, you know, infographics and TV specials did we see about super athletes and the endurance of the human body and, you know, Michael Phelps' lung capacity and stuff like that. And we don't force these people into another class. We don't discriminate against them. We praise them as champions.
Right.
Anyone else's participation in sports comes at somebody else's expense.
That's somebody you might lose to.
Right. That's how sports work. So athletic bans have been very popularly introduced, particularly in this session. We've seen, I think it's about 11 signed into law total over the last 2 years, most recently by Governor Kim Reynolds in Iowa. And I think it's notable how this has really become a litmus test issue amongst a lot of conservative politicians. So for example, Governor Kristi Noem in South Dakota had vetoed one for the stated reason that she was concerned that it would open the state up to lawsuits from the NCAA and others, right? And she received, mountains of criticism from, you know, extremely online members, conservative folks, but definitely felt pressure enough that within a week she said, no, I'm going to come out with this big executive plan. We're going to do so much to defend women's sports. And it's been interesting to me. I mean, just in the last, I think it was last week that you saw Matt Schlapp, founder of CPAC, had posted a New York Post story about Leah Thomas, who's this UPenn swimmer who is now makes daily appearances on Fox News, and had said, I bet she's an interesting person and she deserves compassion. And, you know, in 30 years, her story will be interesting. And you saw Matt Walsh and Steven Crowder and all these people basically mobbing him over the idea that a transgender person might deserve compassion.
Right.
And I think that matches a similar, like I said, a zero tolerance policy, not just for embracing trans rights, but for tolerating transgender people at all. Mm-hmm. For example, I was just reading this morning that there's the GOP primary in Pennsylvania where Dr. Mehmet Oz is ostensibly running against Dave McCormick, who had a history in corporate law. Dr. Oz had a TV special in like 2012 where he interviewed a bunch of families of transgender youth and did not regard them as a existential threat to society. So Fox News promptly took him out to the woodshed for being too soft on trans issues. And similarly, David McCormick then, he had filed a lawsuit on behalf of a transgender person who had faced a exclusionary insurance policy from their employer. And in this Fox News story, it said he even promoted a transgender person within his organization.
Oh, my.
Right. I think those sorts of overreactions are more than just comical. I think they're indicative of how the right really views transgender people, which is as an existential threat, which is as something that you can give no ground to at all, and that they are never apparently willing to integrate into their worldview.
It's been telling, too, the Joe Biden's nominee for Assistant Secretary for Health, Rachel Levine, how much of like a butt of conservative jokes and nasty conservative rhetoric she's been.
Yes. So in a past life, I was a healthcare reporter in Pennsylvania, in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and I had the pleasure of covering Dr. Levine when she was Secretary of the Health of the State of Pennsylvania. Dr. Levine is somebody who cut her teeth in the peak of the AIDS crisis in the 1980s. She founded one of the largest pediatric mental health clinics in the country and led Pennsylvania through an opioid crisis, as well as the coronavirus pandemic. So she's seemed quite naturally like
a very well qualified person for this job.
Right. And during her confirmation hearing, I remember there were questions about, well, you know, this was February of 2021. How do we keep schools open? How do we address vaccine hesitancy? And from, you know, Democrats and Republicans had very, you know, sincere questions about the policy she's looking to enact. And then we get to Senator Rand Paul, and the first two words out of his mouth are genital mutilation and how she, as a transgender woman, defends practices that I described earlier of providing gender-affirming care to trans youth. But I think that piqued a lot of people's attention to her nomination because I think it was a new lowering of the bar for the way that conservatives needed to regard transgender people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the propaganda that Senator Paul was saying, I was unfortunately not a stranger to. I had seen it, but I was used to seeing it in, you know, The Federalist or in The Daily Caller, Breitbart, right? And the mainstreaming of it, you know, Rachel Levine has unfortunately been a major target of that. To the point that now anytime she gets any accolade, there is a virulent reaction to it that feels almost guttural and instinctual. I'm a fan of pointing out, you know, how consistently it's incompetent men decrying a competent woman.
Yeah.
That this is, broadly speaking, a different form of misogyny, trans misogyny, but misogyny all the same. Mm-hmm. Thinking of Dr. Levine's resume and remembering that she's getting criticized on Twitter by Ken Paxton, whose job before attorney general was a corporate lawyer at JCPenney's. so I think that even in sort of reports from folks who study radicalization, there was a report by the Institute for Radicalization and De-Radicalization Studies that looked into the activity of white nationalists in the first 100 days of the Biden administration, and they cited the nomination of Assistant Secretary Levine as a particular flashpoint. And they feel, the white nationalists, that transphobia is an effective gateway drug into broader, more extreme viewpoints because it's treated as more acceptable in broad society and is already present in mainstream conservative circles.
So you've given us a pretty good lay of the land of like how huge, like this mobilization to pass anti-LGBT bills is across the country and state legislatures. 200 anti-LGBTQ bills introduced this session, including over 100 anti-trans bills. Many of them have been passed. But the Texas order, which is about gender-affirming care, is one that has attracted a lot of attention. It seems to kind of encapsulate some of the energies that the nastiest versions of them that are playing out in the right. So could you tell us a little bit about that measure, which is not a piece of legislation, but was an order signed by the governor?
Sure. Last year in the Texas State Legislature, you'll remember that the Texas State Legislature only runs every other year. And there was a bill introduced that would not just ban and criminalize gender-affirming care, as we've seen other states try to do, but deem it child abuse. No court in the country has ever found that gender-affirming care is child abuse. No medical provider has ever regarded gender-affirming care as child abuse. This is a volatile and extreme mischaracterization of this care that really just gives trans kids the same chance to thrive as their peers.
And not to be glib, but given that you've said that the provision of gender-affirming care reduces suicide rates by 70% amongst trans kids, not providing gender-affirming care could be much more plausibly described as child abuse.
100%. To say nothing of if you ban gender-affirming care, what happens to the kids who are already on it is that yeah. they are forcibly detransitioned. So you're talking about, you know, teenage girls who have maybe lived as a girl for a decade, suddenly sprouting an Adam's apple, dealing with facial hair, having their voice irreparably deepened, and really putting these kids through a lot of needless distress. So this bill was introduced, and for one reason or another, it doesn't pass the Texas state legislature. They do pass the trans athlete ban, and there's a brief sigh of relief. Then starting around last August, there's a pressure campaign that Governor Greg Abbott in Texas begins to build up against providers of gender-affirming care in Texas. Gender-affirming care is already fairly difficult to get. There's usually long wait lists. It's oftentimes hard to find an affirming provider, let alone one you're comfortable with. It's particularly hard if you live in rural areas, if you're a non-English speaker. So Governor Abbott reaches out to what was called the Genesis Clinic, which was operated out of this large hospital network, the University of Texas network. And the Genesis network was the only dedicated clinic working with transgender youth in the state. There were a number of other providers, but this was the only dedicated clinic. They published research. They worked with other medical schools. They provided training to general practitioners on working with trans youth. And by November, Governor Abbott convinces the board of this hospital, threatening them with eventual prosecution, which we'll get into, to close this clinic. The hospital does so without consulting the ethics board of the hospital. They begin censoring content within the medical school so people can't learn about working with transgender patients, which, by the way, all doctors are going to work with transgender patients.
Right.
Transgender people need all other kinds of healthcare too. So the closure of this hospital is a precursor to what we saw in February of this year, when the Attorney General Ken Paxton and Governor Greg Abbott partner on an effort to ban gender-affirming care as child abuse under existing law. So having to fail to pass the bill that would have explicitly labeled it child abuse, they now want to go to the state's child abuse statutes, and Ken Paxton writes a non-binding opinion, a memo essentially, stating and making a very facetious argument that gender-affirming care should be prosecuted as child abuse. Notably, he then also says that because it's child abuse, it needs to be reported by all of the state's mandated reporters. And for folks unfamiliar with that term, anytime you're a professional working with children, you sign an agreement to report any signs of child abuse that you see, right?
Right.
And this is a technical and necessary system of the law in order to prevent child abuse. So this is teachers, this is nurses, this is school coaches. If you've ever right. chaperoned at a school field trip, you've probably signed something like this paperwork. And it makes you legally liable if you know of child abuse and fail to report it. So if you label gender-affirming care as child abuse, what you're then doing is forcing thousands upon thousands of professionals across the state to report any child they think might be trans and have access right. to this care. So to differentiate it a bit from a bill that people might be more familiar with, the SB8 abortion ban that was enacted in Texas, whereas SB8 put forward the carrot of the civil process and a $10,000 bounty on anyone who assisted in an abortion, this effort to ban trans care carries the stick, saying that you could be criminally prosecuted if you fail to report a child that you right. think might be trans.
Right.
This is easily the most vicious thing we've seen explicitly done to trans kids by a state, by any measure. The state child welfare agency, at the direction of the governor, has begun investigating these families. These investigations, even in cases where a reasonable person might suggest they're needed, are traumatic. They are arduous. Right. They are very difficult to close. And if they result in a custodial removal, meaning removing children from the home, they are extremely difficult to reverse. Texas's child welfare agency is already deeply overburdened. It's also already facing investigation for harboring a child sex trafficking ring in one of their foster youth agencies.
Yes, I just read that.
Right. So necessarily not an agency that should be sent on a near literal witch hunt for transgender youth.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Has there been sort of consequences of this already? Obviously these investigations have been open, but have you heard from individuals who are like just facing this crackdown?
Yes, cases have been opened. Some families are just in fact fleeing the state. If you cannot get the health care that your child needs to live, you cannot live in that state. Point blank.
I mean, given that gender affirming care could just mean that you're having your kid grow their hair out and use a different pronoun, it seems like mandated reporters would have to report, you know, regardless of whether you're actually accessing all that much health care.
So the Attorney General's opinion didn't lay out social transitions as such. It did lay out puberty blockers, hormone replacement therapy, and explicitly banning them. What's noteworthy, of course, is that when they talk about it, they only talk about surgeries and they only talk about really young kids, which again, really young kids are not receiving these kinds of surgeries.
Right.
What is important to note is that every single one of these efforts to ban gender-affirming care, including Ken Paxton's opinion, exempts intersex children. So intersex people born with indeterminate sexual characteristics, right?
Right.
And this is different from transgender, though not mutually exclusive to it. And a lot of intersex people, when they're infants, soon after they're born, are forced into a surgery where basically doctors or parents decide to try and force their body into a clean gender binary. And a lot of intersex people find this very traumatic. It has long-term health impacts for intersex people. And a broad goal of the intersex rights movement is banning these surgeries. Every effort to ban gender-affirming care for transgender youth exempts intersex surgeries. And I think that's very important to note, because if your goal is protecting consent, if your goal is preventing abuse at the hands of doctors, here's an actual incidence where the nightmare you're describing is happening, and you're exempting it because you actually don't care about the abuse of the consent. You want to allow those surgeries because they enforce gender norms.
Right.
Whereas gender-affirming care helps people transgress gender norms.
Yes. That's such a great point, Jillian. And I think it's worth underscoring too. Sam and I were talking about this a little bit before we recorded. The same political party preventing parents from caring for their children as they need in these cases, they'll turn around and say it's parental decision to not read this book, right? to have access to every ounce of a curriculum that might be used in a classroom, to have cameras in the classroom in some cases, you know, but it's like in one moment, parents' rights are almost insuperable.
Sacrosanct.
Right? Sacrosanct. And in another moment, they're utterly trampled on. And it's just, you know, I mean, it goes back to the great Frank Wilhoit quote that, you know, for the right, there are in-groups whom the law protects but does not bind, and out-groups who the law binds but does not protect. And I think you see that perfectly encapsulated in the kind of shifting position on what parents can and can't do with their children and caring for them.
There's an amazing quote from one of these New York Times articles which points to this exact contradiction. It's from Craig DeRoche, the chief executive of the Family Policy Alliance, which is part of a coalition that's drafting this anti-trans legislation across the country. And he says something, and when I read this, think about the quote that Terry McAuliffe got in so much trouble for about what is taught in school curriculums. This is the quote from DeRoche. He said, "Parents make all sorts of decisions with their kids. And as a community, we chime in as to which decisions should or shouldn't be available to parents."
Oh, really? Is that so?
And if you remember, McAuliffe got in so much trouble for saying that parents don't have total control over whether kids are taught, that the public has some kind of input. And he said it in an even more
innocuous.
even in a more innocuous way than that. But it's indistinguishable from this.
Yeah. So the parents in Texas and parents of trans kids more broadly are unfortunately quite used to people interjecting their opinions into how they raise their children. And they are the focus of harassment, of threats, of conspiracy theories. Patient zero for what happened in Texas in many ways was this guy named Jeff Younger, who is now running for the Texas State House. He's the estranged father of a transgender girl and the estranged ex-husband of a woman that he basically sought to embarrass and suggest that she was forcibly transitioning their transgender daughter, who at the time this first reached public attention was 7 years old. Again, seven-year-olds not accessing this kind of healthcare. Also, I have never, not once, heard of anybody who had been forced into a gender transition in any regard. But using this language and suggesting, you know, going so far as saying that she was chemically castrating the child they had together, he went on a media tour across right-wing media. He, you know, published articles in The Federalist. He went on all these different podcasts. He went on talk radio across Texas, right? He went on speaking tours, netting something like, I think it was a little over $100,000. And we know that figure because a judge ended up trying to force a gag order on him because he filed a suit trying to prevent his transgender daughter from ever being able to access this care without his consent, which she clearly was never going to get. And he got the attention of Greg Abbott. He got the attention of Donald Trump Jr., of Ted Cruz, who threw themselves into the middle of this private custody dispute.
Well, who's more sympathetic to American men on the right than a father who's a piece of shit who's been who's been estranged from his children? Father's rights also has a long pedigree amongst piece of shit conservatives.
Right.
My words, not yours. But and also, again, like to be serious, like how is a guy who's in an ongoing like custody battle with his wife a reliable, you know, source of information about like what she's doing in, you know, in her, in the care that she's providing to her kids, which all the reporting suggests was all done, of course, in the way that you describe with doctors, with psychologists, like it's, she's doing what she's supposed to be doing. And this estranged husband is going on a rampage media tour, making not only his ex-wife, but certainly his daughter's life miserable.
She, his ex-wife received death threats, received animal carcasses at her workplace. And you've seen this, you know, there's a recent story in the New York Post that tried to replicate this pattern of the estranged father desperate to protect the gender roles of his children against the nagging progressive wife, right? Basically, just same story, different characters. And, you know, you can write a history of the last century of American politics based solely on the cartography of shaming mothers, right?
Right.
So I think that that hit for a lot of conservative politicians and propagandists because it followed a very, you know, a pattern they were already prone to believe.
Sure.
And I only raise it because I think it is important sort of showing how within right-wing media, these single narratives get turned into extremely vicious and cruel policies. And we've seen this around trans athletes too, where they focus on, you know, the one or two examples they have of a transgender athlete and raise it up as, you know, this is the enemy, right?
Right.
You know, I saw like there was an op-ed in the Salt Lake City Tribune earlier today by somebody who was fighting for an athlete ban in the state of Utah. And as Equality Utah, the statewide LGBT rights organization, pointed out, there are 85,000 K-12 athletes in Utah, and four are transgender. Not 400, four. And which almost makes it more cruel because you're basically telling those four kids, I just want to make you miserable. Yeah. And again, I think it speaks to if you really believe that there is a crazed liberal conspiracy to brainwash children and subject them to permanent medical treatments, then of course you're going to act with zero tolerance towards transgender people or our rights.
Well, Jillian, maybe that's a good way to move toward some of the groups pushing these bills and this messaging, injecting it into right-wing politics, whether it's via the media or the legislation, who's actually pushing this? And I think we'll be able to talk about some people and groups we haven't really touched much on the show before, like the American Principles Project, which we mentioned in the context of that ad in Kentucky. And it was founded by Robert George, Princeton professor, who I knew, you know, pretty well in my young conservative days. You know, who are some of the groups behind this? Maybe a kind of a quick rundown, because I think too, talking about the groups will let us start connecting some dots and exploring kind of the logic such as it is, of their position, you know, what rhetorical moves they're making, how they're framing this issue, and what all that implies, and also how to fight back against it. But to start with, where are the groups pushing this? Where's this coming from?
So I think the Alliance Defending Freedom is a good starting point simply because they're easily the most powerful in this regard. They were a major player in the fight against marriage equality.
They mostly do legal work, right?
Yes.
Like religious liberty lawsuits.
Impact litigation. Yes.
Impact litigation. Yes.
Basically finding individual cases for which to set important precedents, right? People might know them from, for example, the Masterpiece Cake Shop case at the Supreme Court. And this was a baker in Colorado, Jack Phillips, who refused to bake a cake for a gay wedding.
They're a big part of the war to protect Christmas, too, I remember, in the aughts.
Oh, good.
They were on the front lines of the war on Christmas.
Well, I'm glad they did.
They lost. I mean, we don't celebrate that holiday here anymore. Too bad.
Right. And they also, what's important to know is that they operate the Blackstone Legal Academy, which trains, I mean, thousands upon thousands of lawyers in basically the art of...
Dark arts of right-wing legal maneuvering. And the Blackstone Fellowship was the one, listeners might recall, Amy Coney Barrett, when she was nominated both for the Circuit Court and then later for the Supreme Court, you know, her speaking before the Blackstone Fellows and her work with the ADF came under fire.
Yeah, I think she was a faculty member at the fellowship. So
yeah, she. I remember in her first hearing to the Circuit Court, she was questioned by a senator who said, "Are you familiar that they advocate to abolish same-sex marriage? Do you know that ADF International fights for laws in other countries where transgender people are forcibly sterilized?" And she said, "No, I wasn't familiar with that," in her 2017 hearing to the Circuit Court. And then flash forward to 2020 when she's in a hearing before being nominated to the Supreme Court. She's asked the same question and says, "No, I hadn't heard of that." And to say that you had not heard that the ADF was engaged in anti-LGBT litigation is akin to saying you didn't know Popeye sells chicken. Like, it's what they do.
This brilliant woman. Right? Maybe the answers to that were on the blank piece of paper she held up to show she didn't have any notes.
Oh, if only the notes had saved her.
And that's also where information about climate change was too, which she also, she's not a scientist, so she has no idea about if climate change is real or not.
I mean, the international stuff that the ADF has supported was like preventing the decriminalization of sodomy laws, like in the Caribbean.
Yeah.
It's really sick stuff abroad, and of course now here as well. Of course,
they are broadly speaking a Christian nationalist organization, right? They believe in very much a biblical interpretation of gender roles, and they believe that it's the government's job to enforce those gender roles. So a big role they play is not just training lawyers who then become lifetime appointed judges, but also writing legislation similar to ALEC, who some listeners of the show might be familiar with.
That stands for what? The American Legislative Exchange Council.
Yes.
And that's like a state-level policy group on the right.
Right. You know, they're basically a legislation factory.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
They print up copycat legislation that then gets distributed throughout these states. And I mean, you know, the lawyers that I've worked with and people in these states can tell you, looking at anti-trans athlete bans, looking at the bans of gender-affirming care, the same way that if you look at abortion bans, you'll see broadly similar language. You'll see basically copy and paste. An occasion we've even seen where errors made in one pre-filed bill were replicated in a pre-filed bill in another state.
Yeah,
right.
It's very hard to sort of trace like one bill back to one of these organizations, but we do know at least a few the ADF has taken credit for, and we know that they're very engaged in this. And of course, they are sort of playing both ends of the equation then, right? Because they're writing the bills that would then get heard by judges they've trained in arguments that they're making.
So
they are, suffice it to say, probably the most active organization against trans rights in the country. Outside of them is a relative newcomer, the American Principles Project. This is an organization, as you said, founded by Robert George, and the public face of which is a man named Terry Schilling. Around 2018, 2019, so again, if you remember back to this time, certainly while the Trump administration was working to repeal transgender rights, a lot of rank and file members of the GOP were very wary of touching transgender rights because of Pat McCrory's loss in North Carolina. So shortly after that, around 2018, you see the American Principles Project, and a few others engage in sort of poll testing, right? Doing focus groups, doing push polling, which is where you're not really trying to measure people's opinion, but testing messaging language. And they find that using the extremely weighted language around things like trans athletes, around things like gender affirming care, they find that, you know, a broad base of Americans, say, would endorse a ban on trans athletes. There have since been some more independent polls, like out of NPR and PBS, that contradict a lot of that, which the APP doesn't tend to take nice to. Because, you know, this is what they're selling, frankly, right? Like, mm-hmm. I thought, Sam, of your great article on Christopher Rufo. And I think to what Christopher Rufo is to CRT, I think the APP is to so-called gender ideology, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's basically, you know, the entrepreneurial spirit of spreading bigoted ideals in legislation.
Right.
Terry Schilling himself is, I think, indicative of where trans rights fits into the broader need among most parts of the right to enforce a, you know, a gender regime. Terry Schilling doesn't believe in no-fault divorce, for example. He usually speaks of women as their sole function in life being the caring and raising of children. And I don't think that's a coincidence, right? That he then wants to do everything he can to erase transgender people from public life. And the misnomer that it's being done in the interest of, say, protecting women's sports, an issue in which he has no experience, I think it's important to have that context of the rest of the viewpoints they hold and the rest of the work they do.
It's interesting. I mentioned I knew Robbie George, the founder of the American Principles Project, and I don't know what his current involvement with it is, I should say. You know, I was thinking in preparation for this, back to, you know, one of Robbie's early books, one of his proper academic books was called Making Men Moral. And the title always struck me because it's so straightforward. It is the role of government to make men moral, men, you know, human beings moral, that's a proper function of government, and it may be an inevitable function, but one that, you know, conservatives should embrace. And I do think there was a way in which, yes, on abortion, that always fit in quite well with what the Republican Party wanted to do. But there was also that kind of like lingering, a little bit of keep the government out of your wallet and your bedroom sensibility that kind of existed on the right as kind of more libertarian instinct in some ways. And I was thinking it's interesting that something like the American Principles Project has been so important of late in pushing anti-trans bills and legislation, sentiment, rhetoric, as we see the old synthesis that included libertarians falling apart. You know, on the show, we've mostly talked about economics, right? Like that part of the conservative coalition, libertarian economics falling out of favor. But it's interesting that some of the more libertarian instincts, maybe live and let live, the government shouldn't pry into certain intimate areas, that we see that kind of falling away too, and that something like Robbie George's hard-edged social conservatism, again, the author Making Men Moral, we know what moral means for people like him and his allies. You know, Jillian, you mentioned that George had picked up on some of the more extreme aspects of the anti-abortion movement.
So in 1994, First Things, of all places, held a symposium on killing abortionists. I'm not kidding. That's what it was called.
Literally, killing abortionists, colon, a symposium.
And there was a lot of contributors, and one of them was Robert George. And he gave this quote, which is, of course, you can hear in it that it is meant to be a sort of
Swiftian.
Yes. If you want to be maximally sympathetic, then you could say it's a Swiftian modest proposal. But this is literally what he wrote. I am personally opposed to killing abortionists. However, inasmuch as my personal opposition to this practice is rooted in a sectarian Catholic religious belief in the sanctity of human life, I am unwilling to impose it on others who may, as a matter of conscience, take a different view.
And it goes on from there.
It goes on from there. But even in the context of a ho 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 we're so funny tongue in cheek discussion in a country where people who perform abortions and people who provide reproductive health care are literally endangered and are killed, to even make that joke is just indicative of where he's coming from on these issues.
He closes it by saying, I believe in policies that reduce the urgent need some people feel to kill abortionists, while at the same time respecting the rights of conscience of my fellow citizens who believe that the killing of abortionists is sometimes a tragic necessity. Not a good, but a lesser evil. In short, I am moderately pro-choice.
Yeah, yeah. Ha, so, ha, ha.
Yes.
But look, but this is one of those things where I think it actually does get at something that I find to be prevalent and symptomatic in all of this stuff, which is that the people who push these socially conservative laws, whether they're about abortion or they're about trans kids, they perceive themselves as moral crusaders on the side of right, but they are incapable of thinking about the consequences for real human beings. Or maybe they do, and they enjoy the fact that they're causing them pain and that they're inflicting cruelty on them. I can't make that judgment. But the flippant way in which George makes this joke about killing abortionists, I think, is actually symptomatic of the way that you can't get conservatives to talk seriously about the consequences of these bills. These trans kids do not exist, it seems. It's all this abstract first principle, metaphysical disagreement about what a man is and what a woman is. And if we can't resolve that, then how can we live in the same country?
Yeah.
And then once it comes down to the fact that you've passed this bill in Texas, which is like terrorizing trans kids and their family, all of their Christian charity is completely out the window. I mean, there's no sense of the actual stakes for human beings.
So the language they use that you see in right-wing media and from these legislators and certainly from Attorney General Paxton's order, when talking about gender-affirming care as it applies to youth, is a fear of regret. Well, what happens if they access this care and they don't like it or they change their mind, right? Which, oh, wow, these providers never thought of that. No, of course they thought of that. Like there's safeguards, right? The standards of care, like I said, are the result of, you know, decades, if not a century of research. And right now, to the studies I've seen, particularly amongst the people who are accessing like puberty blockers and HRT when they're kids, the regret rate is something like 0.5%, 0.5%, which is a better satisfaction rate than like most knee surgeries. I'm always a fan of pointing out that among adults who access gender-affirming surgeries, the dissatisfaction rate, let's call it, usually hovers between 1% and 2%. Among people who have had children, the regret over the decision to have children hovers between 7% and 15%. So I don't think that they're afraid that trans people are going to regret this care. I think they're afraid of trans people.
Yes.
I think that they are afraid that the existence of trans people poses an existential threat to their broader effort to enforce a strict gender binary and the complementarian roles that go along with it. I wanted to come back to what Robert George said about abortion providers. There was a bill introduced in Idaho a few weeks ago that would threaten providers of gender-affirming care to trans youth with lifetime in prison. And this was being discussed on Twitter as it was proposed. And there was a fellow at the Claremont Institute, you know, John Eastman might be a more familiar name to a number of listeners out of the Claremont Institute, who said, well, why stop there? Why not threaten them with the death penalty? And I think it's important to know what abortion and gender-affirming care have in common, which is that they give people control over their own life path as it pertains to gender, right? In Europe, when there are efforts to ban abortion, restrict rights for LGBT people more broadly, as well as, you know, roll back, you know, feminist gains and rights for women, it's usually framed as anti-gender. There is a important consideration of the idea of gender as itself extreme. The notion that you could have a role to play other than what has been ordained by God or instructed by biology is hostile to nearly every corner of the conservative movement. Mm-hmm. So if you really view it that way, if you hold a worldview that is that threatened by the ability of, you know, anyone with a uterus to choose a life other than caregiving, or even just choose caregiving on their own time, as well as the ability of trans people to thrive and feel safe, if you are threatened by those things to such a grave degree, of course you're going to invoke these really extreme measures, which is how we get to Texas, where you have the same governor who puts out a platform on parents' rights, suddenly turning and saying, except you. You, I'm going to threaten to take your children out of your home, forcibly right. detransition them in a gravely traumatic experience, one that we know will raise their chances for an early death, because yeah. I don't like what you're doing. You yeah. only act that way towards a kind of person, or, you know, a medical technology for that matter, that threatens everything you know about the world.
You know, Jillian, I think this is really important. And there's two things I want to maybe clarify or introduce that I'd be interested in your thoughts on, and Sam's too. One of which is, you know, we haven't talked about some of the other, like the Don't Say Gay bill in Florida. And we don't need to necessarily get into that in depth, but we're seeing a focus on children,
right?
As if they're coming for your children. Right. Teachers are grooming your children. Gay teachers especially are grooming your children. It's a linking between trans issues, LGBTQ issues more broadly, and the grooming of children.
Predators.
QAnon. And now we see the way this is working. It's you know, that's now out there, right, in the media, in people's kind of consciousness. And now we see with Judge Jackson, nominated for the Supreme Court, Josh Hawley, picking up on her record when it comes to sentencing child pornography offenders.
Right.
Right. And saying she's a kind of on the side of child abusers and child pornographers and those yeah. who access those materials. So we see that. On the other hand, as you're getting at, it does connect outward to other issues. Like we've pointed out that, you know, when we talked about the National Conservatism Conference, the first one, Yoram Hazony connected borders with trans issues. Mm-hmm. And I think you can see the need for like clear lines, rigidity, you know, established rules, established hierarchies. We read in preparation for this an essay that Judith Butler wrote for The Guardian back in October of 2021. And one of the things she pointed out was the way the very term gender, which I think is what you were driving at, as she put it, attracts, condenses, and electrifies a diverse set of social and economic anxieties that she links to neoliberal, you know, economic regimes, but also against the backdrop of intensifying social inequality and the pandemic. So the gender issues are, they're both being inflamed in a very specific direction, meaning the grooming of children, and they seem to be tied to a broader set of issues about kind of our place in the world and identity, right? The borders between countries, the rules between genders, male, female, clear lines. You know, there's something going on there too.
And similarly with what Jillian was saying about sort of gender roles and sort of social reproduction.
Exactly.
You know, Tucker Carlson saying that trans people are, quote, a threat to the perpetuation of the species, that as Jillian pointed out, if people born with uteruses are not going to use them to have children, whether because they're going to transition or because they're going to have an abortion, that, you know, it's a threat to the preservation of the, he won't say, but the white race. Right. And so that there's a social reproduction element here too. The sort of emphasis that's coming back, it never left, but it's so strong right now. And you hear it amongst younger conservative activists more than you would expect. This trad ideology that, like, I'm just looking for a wife to stay at home and have a bunch of kids. There's such a fixation on it and an anxiety about traditional heteropatriarchal social reproduction, to use, you know, highfalutin academic language, but which is just to say the perpetuation of a certain kind of family in a certain kind of economy, which serves to preserve a certain kind of social order.
So in Attorney General Paxton's opinion, you know, his edict declaring gender-affirming care child abuse, one of the concerns that he raises is, in his words, and it's hard to say it without gagging, the constitutional right of the minor child to procreate. And what he's interested in is basically some low-grade medical concern that exists with puberty blockers and HRT around fertility, you know, later in life for kids. A sane person might suggest that then we could expand fertility options. We could expand access to things like IVF and surrogacy. And instead, there's an effort to use that to fearmonger about the supposed long-term consequences of access. to gender-affirming care.
Right, right.
You mentioned the Don't Say Gay Bill in Florida, and one of the other categories of bills that I didn't get to is there's been a lot of limitations on curriculum in schools and also a lot on book bans for really the last 10 years. Books by LGBT authors or about LGBT people have ranked among the top, if not dominated the top, of the American Library Association's list of the most challenged books. They've seen a massive increase in those challenges, particularly in the last 2 years. Easily the most challenged book in the last few years has been a picture book called Melissa's Story by Alex Gyno, which is just about a transgender girl deciding that she likes to wear dresses. That's it. Mm-hmm. The Southern Poverty Law Center has tracked white nationalists organizing protests outside of public libraries because they host drag queen story hours.
Oh, yeah.
There's a broad effort to portray basically any exposure to LGBT lives, experiences, or people as inherently abusive or inherently threatening.
Yes.
Yeah, as a form of grooming.
Right. This is certainly not new. We've seen like Anita Bryant and Save Our Children.
And the Satanic Panic.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
I think that's such a good point because I think it's worth even putting a finer point on it that when they say grooming, like the kind of thing that they're trying to stigmatize is just the possibility that a child might meet a gay person or a trans person. Mm-hmm. And that person might be able to let them know, I'm gay, I'm trans. Yeah.
In the most ordinary of ways.
In the most ordinary of ways.
Like the way a teacher might reference a spouse.
Yeah, right. But I'm also saying that the thing that they're trying to criminalize is indeed one of the ways in which we have made progress, which is that a kid who's going through the crisis of coming out, having a hard time finding themselves, that they might actually meet somebody who's been through that too and is a caregiver and who can talk to them about it, you know, and might have a shared experience of it. And like that is like actually the precise thing that they're most agitated about is the thing that, you know, that like a lot of kids need more than anything else, mm-hmm. you know? Maybe it's like counterproductive to point that out because it gives ammunition to the idea that like teachers are saying, hey, you know, I am gay, to a kid who says, I think I might be gay. And, you know, maybe they shouldn't do that. But what I am saying that like most of what terrifies them is the impulse of good people to be good caregivers. Mm. And I think I find it absolutely fucking disgusting.
I see it as a hegemonic project, right?
Yes.
Like thinking of Mark Fisher and capitalist realism, right? And this idea mm-hmm. that you need to deem all alternatives to capitalism completely unworkable, if not outright hostile. Similarly, any, you know, framework of gender roles or families that exists outside of a core, you know, breadwinner and caregiver framework and a strictly cisgender and heterosexual one must be ruled completely unworkable. And mm-hmm. the people who pursue them as eventually punished some way, right? Mm-hmm. And this figures very frequently into a lot of anti-trans propaganda, particularly coverage in sort of the right-wing blogosphere. And something that I've been conscious about just in my own messaging is that we obviously want to speak to the harm that transgender people experience and the grave threats and risks posed by a lot of these legislative efforts. But part of me does wonder whether always only speaking to that harm and making it mm-hmm. seem like transgender people have nothing but misery and nothing but trauma to experience mm-hmm. doesn't mm-hmm. reinforce that idea that mm. our lives can't be filled with joy, that yeah. our lives are not worth living and are in fact a danger to others, right?
Right.
And there's mm-hmm. a stigma, even subconsciously, the stigmatizing impact when you talk about people going through hardship, right? And right. there's on some level, you're going to run into, you know, mass audiences that watch people go through something hard and believe that they've deserved it and brought it upon themselves. Mm-hmm. And they are severely threatened by the idea that trans people could be happy if they were actually right. supported yeah. or if the restraints were actually pulled off of them. They mm-hmm. are existentially terrified of the joy of transgender people.
Yeah.
Likewise, I mean, you talked about sort of the framework of social reproduction and reproductive labor. If you're somebody who lives through the world with a very strict understanding of who plays those roles, that it's only, you know, people with penises who are breadwinners and only people with gestational capacity who are caregivers, and you wanted to find those things as masculine and feminine, right? Then the very idea of a pregnant man is terrifying to you. Right. I think of the reaction that we saw to the news that Pete Buttigieg had taken parental leave, right?
Yes.
He and Chastain Buttigieg adopted two babies, and Pete Buttigieg, as many more fathers should do, took the 2 weeks paternity leave to spend time with his new children. And he was mocked with Tucker Carlson saying, what are you going to do, breastfeed them, right? And you saw basically a lot of conservatives admitting they don't do much as fathers and saying, well, what is there to do?
Sometimes unintentionally. Right? Like when my kid came home from the hospital, you know, the kid just ate a lot and slept and it didn't seem like there was much to do. So I went back to work. It's like that your poor wife.
And if you find any association between masculinity and reproductive labor and care work as antithetical to your worldview, then of course the very idea of the phrase pregnant people is going to turn that upside down. There was a conservative writer, David Mastio, on Twitter the other day who he had left his position at USA Today where he was an editor. And he said, I can finally say what I've been waiting to say. People don't get pregnant, but women do. And I was like, those aren't mutually exclusive categories, are they? Like, women are people. We agree on that point, right?
I don't know if you saw, Matt, you probably saw Dave Rubin, who's a sort of gay conservative. Well, now he's conservative. He used to be kind of like a
personality.
He's like an intellectual dark web type guy. Yeah. But he and his husband are having a kid with a surrogate, and they posted a picture of themselves with a ultrasound. And it was a huge thing on the right because some people on the right were like, congrats. And then a lot of the like actual kind of freaks were like, oh, this is disgusting. Where did that baby come from? So they even go after their own, of course.
Sure. And we've talked a lot about the T in LGB, right? But, you know, PRI put out another round of polling earlier this morning, and certainly not the first one we've seen, to show that marriage equality, which was previously the dawn of the new Sodom, according to conservatives, now has majority support in the Republican Party.
Well, I mean, Jillian, that's why, you know, I was thinking when you were talking about the joy of trans people and how that should be focused on, too. Maybe the right saw, you know, the way people reacted to all these photos from fabulous gay weddings and how people fawned over them and loved them so much. And those were images of joy. And, you know, that's such an amazing point. You know, that's what they don't want people to see.
I want to ask you maybe one final thing, which kind of goes in a slightly different direction than where we've been, which is, I think it was you who posted on Twitter about how massively Americans overestimate how many trans people there are in the country. Was that you?
It was a YouGov poll, and they found that they averaged, I guess, America's estimated size of different populations, right? And they said the transgender 20% transgender of people, 20% of people in the United States are transgender. It's a little south of 2. In the actual figures.
I appreciated also that they thought there were like 20% Jews. No, that we're managed to control everything with just 1%.
I mean, if trans people are 20%, then like gays and lesbians must be what, 70?
Well, this is actually kind of what I would suggest because I think one of the things that we've talked about with gay marriage is the way in which what produced the kind of breaking point in some ways was the fact that a lot of people ultimately knew somebody who was gay, maybe somebody in their family, like a lot of conservatives who used to be like hard charging anti-gay, then their daughter's gay and they're like, okay, maybe I won't be so crazy. But trans people are such a smaller percentage of the population. And I think that it seems to me, and I'll be interested what you think about this, that it helps the conservatives be able to think about trans people as so abstract and not as like some like person that they know, which, you know, contributes to their ability to be like just profoundly inhumane in their legislative and rhetorical response to the existence of trans people.
I think that's right. One thing I will say is that when we talk about marriage equality and we talk about the fight that led to the 2015 Supreme Court case that legalized same-sex marriage nationwide, there is a tendency to look to that sort of proximity argument, right? That people got to know gays and lesbians in their own lives, and they saw them on TV, and they were in commercials, and you know, it's sort of like an argument by visibility was what led to that, right? The fight for marriage equality was the result of decades of enduring and expensive organizing. Massive amounts of fundraising, huge support from the world of philanthropy and from corporate donors. And oftentimes people suggest
it was just natural going to happen.
Right. And, you know, it's just listening to Timothy Snyder, the historian, and he was talking about Ukraine and Russia, but he was talking about the politics of inevitability, right?
Yes.
This idea of like the end of history and the moral arc of the universe bending towards justice, right? The inevitability of social progress. Right now, transgender people are in an asymmetrical war for our rights. So we talked about some of the large conservative players who are fighting against trans people, but it is really the entire conservative movement that regards transgender people as top line a priority as they do immigration and abortion. Yeah. That they talk about it constantly and are constantly in an effort for it. Something like $8 out of every $100 that was given to the LGBT movement has gone to trans-led causes. And there is, I mean, you look to Texas, and certainly there are large players like the ACLU and the Human Rights Campaign, and there are trans-led organizations across the country, in cities across the country, but most of what they're doing is having just to fight to keep people safe. It's fighting to get people into housing. It's doing direct service work. It's doing harm reduction. It's getting people to take you know, the massive crisis of trans violence seriously, right? Last year, we saw more reported homicides against transgender people than we've seen in any other year. And those organizations are at their complete limit. And they are being faced with, you know, the juggernaut of the entire conservative movement. So while I do appreciate the power of visibility and the power of cultural representation, right? And it's notable that you're seeing, you know, like the most influential show at Gen Z is Euphoria and has Hunter Schaefer as a massive star, right? Like that holds significant weight. But visibility without protection is a trap.
Right.
And right now, we don't have protection.
That's such a good point, because actually the conservatives are obsessed with the visibility.
Yeah.
They think there's trans people everywhere. The reason they think that there's 20% trans people is because, well, they're all like watching. They're all obsessed with trans people. So they watch TV with trans people on it. And they're like, look, there's trans people everywhere. And it drives them crazy. But they actually have the political power to make trans people's lives miserable, whereas trans people and trans organizations don't have the political power to keep them safe.
Right. Yeah. Jillian, I wanted to just echo Sam's comment. What an important point it is that visibility without protection is a trap, I think, as you put it. But the issue of marriage equality, there's a book called Flagrant Conduct by Dale Carpenter, about the story of Lawrence v. Texas. And, you know, that really opened my eyes. I read it when it first came out years ago, about the network of people on the ground, organizations, gay rights organizations, such that when this possible test case came up, the road that traveled to actual litigation was quite incredible, especially getting before the Supreme Court. And so all that's to say, you're totally correct that inevitability is always a bad argument in politics, and it's always the product of hard work. And I just wondered, too, if, you know, listeners might be thinking, how can they help? Are there particular organizations you would recommend donating to, or other advice if people listen to this and they're really incensed, as we all should be, but you feel powerless? What would you tell people if they ask for recommendations?
Sure. This was something that came up a lot after the Texas order, because it wasn't a piece of legislation. Like, how do you fight, you know, just a ruling by edict, really? And something that I kept having to tell people is that the best way to fight for families with trans kids in Texas is to prevent it from happening in your own backyard. And there are trans people in your city, in your state right now, who are fighting for their safety and their dignity. And a great directory you can go to find them. There's an organization that's not as well known. It's called the Trans Justice Funding Project. The Trans Justice Funding Project. And you can actually, what they do is they're almost like a bundler of philanthropic dollars. So they take donations and they distribute them to small independent trans-led organizations. And they even have it where the organizations have a budget cap. Like if they're over a certain size, they don't qualify for the grant because it's meant as like seed money, basically.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And I would strongly recommend if you're looking for a place to like sign up for regular donations or even just give once, I really recommend the Trans Justice Funding Project. And they have a great digital directory of their grantees where you can find those organizations that are right in your neighborhood who are definitely in need of your support.
Cool. We'll put something like that in the show notes.
Excellent. Yeah. Maybe to close out, one of the things I've been thinking of this whole conversation, especially since we touched on the banning of books that relate to LGBTQ themes, was James Baldwin's book, Giovanni's Room. And there's a line relatively early in it where he says that people are too various to be treated so lightly. And I've thought about this whole, the lightness with which the lives of trans people, but not only trans people, are treated by some of these goons is just, that's what really sickens me, you know? No curiosity, no empathy, no sense of a regard for dignity across difference.
And yeah, it's really beautiful, yeah.
Sam and I are both just really grateful you took the time to talk with us. I'm sure you're very busy these days, and these aren't the easiest times, but you've been really brilliant and really, really grateful for the time you took to enlighten us and help us understand what's happening better.
No problem. This has been an enormous pleasure. I've been such a huge fan of you guys since you first started, really, because I remember trying to figure out why is the National Conservative Conference angry at my work? thank you for just letting me go in depth and give this issue the nuance and attention it deserves. It really means a lot.
Thanks, Jillian. This was really fun. I mean, troubling, but a good time.
Yeah.
Thank you again.
That was my cat having a panic attack. Apologies.